This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
A remarkable new film tells the story of an anti-war movement that the U.S. establishment have tried to erase from history. Sir, No Sir documents opposition to the Vietnam War that took place not at Woodstock or in the streets of San Francisco, but on American military bases at home and abroad. The GI movement, as it was known at the time, was made up of both Vietnam vets and active duty soldiers, and it was huge. David Zeiger directed the film, and he joins me this morning from Los Angeles. Hello, David.
Hello, good morning.
Now, the film begins in the early 1960s when there wasn't really a movement. There were just some isolated individuals who took a stand against the war. And one of them was a dermatologist called Howard Levy. Can you tell us about him and what he did?
Yeah, Howard's story is very interesting and kind of emblematic of what was going on in the early days of the war. Howard was a doctor who had been drafted went into the... He's from New York. He went in the service and was stationed down in North Carolina. And he found himself ordered to train Green Beret medics in dermatology, which was rather a strange thing, he thought, to do. But what he discovered was that he was training Green Beret medics how to treat a very common jungle disease, skin disease. And the idea was that the medics, and this was kind of part of what was going on in the early days of the war, the medics would go into a village, they would treat the children for this disease, and that way win over the heart, as he puts it, win the hearts and minds of the people. But increasingly, as was becoming known, at the same time, as Howard says, they were bombing the hell out of the villages. And he realized at a certain point that this was simply against his principles and unethical. And what he refused to do was train the Green Beret medics. That was enough of a crime in the eyes of the military to have him court-martialed with a general court-martial, and he was sentenced to 3 years in prison. And he became kind of one of the first people who became publicly known from inside the military as opposing the war.
When did the GI movement really start to take off in a more general way?
The turning point in the movement, as we talk about in the film, really was the Tet Offensive in 1968. Just a very brief background. Up until then, the general word that was put out by the military and the government was that we were winning in Vietnam and that there were being tremendous advances being made, that the people supported us. This all sounds very familiar, of course. And in 1968, during the Tet holiday, the National Liberation Front, North Vietnamese, launched an offensive that enveloped the entire country and before it was driven back, and showed very clearly that the people supported them, that the people in Vietnam opposed the United States, and that the United States simply could not win that war. And at that point, there were already 500,000 troops in Vietnam, and the general morale and sense among the troops of whether this was really a valid war or whether it was a war that could be won became, you know, it really started to turn against the war in a big way among a lot of the troops.
At what point did you become involved?
I got involved in 1970. I was 20 years old in 1970. I had managed to not get drafted up until then. And I had been very, you know, over the last couple of years, I've been very kind of quickly turning against the war. I never supported it, but I reached a point where I thought there was nothing I could do other than really work against the war that made sense. And I learned about the GI movement, and I moved down to Texas, to a little town called Killeen, which is a army town just outside Fort Hood, which was one of the largest U.S. bases. And there was a coffee house there called the Oleo Strut, and I worked there for a couple of years as a civilian staff, and it was an anti-war coffee house. It was a place where GIs came to talk about the war, talk about racism in the military, talk about bigger political issues, and to organize. They put out a newspaper, they formed organizations, they held demonstrations, and I kind of acted as a kind of 24-hour day support for that.
And this was a coffee house that was in the town, and yet soldiers from the base could go there and they could read anti-war material there.
Yeah, it was something that had been started in 1968 by a couple of anti-war activists, and they set up some coffee houses in several bases around the country. Very quickly, they became kind of a lightning rod, both for GIs against the war and also for the military and for kind of the more right-wing forces in these towns. Even though, in most cases, the coffee houses were couldn't be declared off limits, although the military tried to do that in several cases. The town authorities did everything they could to try to shut them down. We had a lot of problem with kind of what we call goat ropers, like, you know, kind of high school kids and general kind of right wing types in the area who would come and try to cause trouble. But they lasted for several years, the coffee houses, and had varying degrees of success as being centers for GIs organizing.
What was the significance of the name, the Olio Strut? It's an unusual name.
Yeah, Olio Strut came from the guys in the military at the time. The helicopter being used in Vietnam was called a Huey helicopter, and that was the Olio Strut was a vertical shock absorber. It basically cushioned the helicopter and kept it from flying out of control. And we felt like the place was originally kind of set up as being a shock absorber for people, guys in the military, a place where they could come out and breathe easy and say what they believed and think what they thought, you know, outside of the eyes of the military.
How well known was the GI movement outside of activist circles, among the public as a whole, in the media?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that it was, the GI movement was reported on very widely in the media at the time, both in local media and in the national media. When we were researching the film, we found, literally hours of reports on national news and, hundreds and hundreds of articles in the Los Angeles Times and New York Times and whatever about the GI movement. We use in the film, Walter Cronkite on CBS Evening News did a two-part special on the GI underground press. It was very widely reported on and generally very widely known. In the state of Texas, I know that Fort Hood and the GI movement was kind of the center of the anti-war movement in the state for a long time. At the time, people did know about it, or at least had heard about it in some manner.
Now, I said in my introduction that it was a huge movement. How big was it?
Well, it was a movement on a number of different levels. As we talked about earlier, it started out small in the early to mid-60s. And by 1971, there were literally thousands of people in the military who were actively working against the war in a number of ways. There was a network of underground newspapers, very loose network. There were, people who have researched this have counted, over 300 separate underground papers that were published in the course of the war on military bases by GIs. Sometimes it was one or two guys putting it together. Sometimes it was a staff of 20. There were in 1970 and 71, for example, on Armed Forces Day, which is a national, not a holiday, but a day to recognize the military, there were demonstrations of active duty GIs at bases around the country. And in Texas, at Fort Hood, we had in 1970 there were about 1,000 GIs who came out and demonstrated, and in 1971 there were over 1,500 who came out and demonstrated. And this is in the face of the government, not the government. This is the face of the military, basically threatening people. You know, it was very, very dangerous to actively oppose the war in the military, and people were being threatened. People were being jailed for petty offenses. The military is famous for just using very petty things to put people in the stockade or to kick people out or whatever. So while you can't have, there were organizations that the American Servicemen's Union said they had 1,000 or 20,000 members. It's hard to, kind of pinpoint exactly, but you get a real sense from that there was, on just about every military base in the world, there were, anywhere from a group of two or three guys to hundreds who were very actively opposing the war, and they were not they were generally welcomed by a large a lot of the troops. It was everyone that we interviewed and everyone that I talked to and from what I remember back there, talked about the fact that they could pretty much, you know, by the early 70s, were pretty much free and open with what they believed and putting that out. And the military's attempts to suppress that were thwarted mainly by the fact that they just didn't have that much of an audience inside the military for that.
Did the GI movement, do you think, influence the direction that the war took as time passed?
I think it absolutely did. There was another layer. I mean, there was an organized GI movement, and then there was, of course, the general sentiment in the military that wasn't necessarily part of the movement, but increasingly and very openly was hostile to the military and to the government and to the war in particular. We talk about in the film, and again, this was reported on the national news, a wave of hundreds and hundreds of incidents of what was called fragging of GIs. Literally assassinating unpopular officers and NCOs with using a fragmentation grenade or shooting them. I mean, this was an open thing that was being worried about by the military, and the Pentagon itself documented 600 cases. Now, it's pretty hard to conduct a ground war when this is what's happening. And in news reports and in you know, when you look back at the source material at that time in 70, 71, 72, this was being openly talked about in the military, that they no longer had an effective ground force. The Army and the Marines were in shambles, and the organized movement, along with the general sentiment of, you know, this is, you know, I'm just not going to participate in this, was so extreme that it certainly had a big influence on the fact that the military really had to kind of pull out of the ground war and replace it with the air war, which you know, then kind of prompted a very widespread movement inside the Air Force and Navy as well.
So when they moved to the air war, then there was resistance among the soldiers to participating in the air war also.
Oh, absolutely. And that resistance, we had a very direct effect on the war. A group of people that are in the film were people who were very top-level, high-security, basically interpreters who would intercept radio messages from the North Vietnamese, and they provided the information that was needed to conduct the air war. And these guys, you know, who were based in Thailand, almost universally turned against the war from their direct experience of seeing what the air war was doing to the people in North Vietnam. And even to the point where when the Nixon administration launched what was called the Christmas bombings in 1972, a massive bombing raid on North Vietnam, these guys went on strike, and the information that was getting back to the military was not what they needed, and it had a huge effect on things.
That was a very interesting part of the film, because they were talking about how, because they were listening to people communicating with each other in Vietnamese, they were the translators, as you said, that they started to feel an identification with those people because they spent so much time listening to them.
Absolutely. And this was something, you know, we didn't go into it in the film in relation to the ground war, but this was something a lot of ground troops talked about as well, because there was a lot of, you know, opportunity for GIs to kind of, you know, if they wanted to have connection with Vietnamese people, you know, in the bases and in the towns. And I mean, one of the things that everyone realized at some point was that everyone in Vietnam was a potential VC, a potential enemy, because that's who they supported. And on the other hand, a lot of people talked about how they kind of saw this incredible culture that was just being eviscerated by the American war, and that was a big part of their you know, what turned them against the war in the first place.
One of the revelations for me when I saw the film was that the troops were not only refusing to fight in Vietnam, but they were also, some of them, refusing to be sent to repress civil unrest at home. And you talk with soldiers from Fort Hood who refused to go to the Democratic Party National Convention in Chicago in 1968. Do you think the people who were out in the streets knew about this at the time?
Some. But that's another part of this whole dynamic that's been really written out of history, is how much the U.S. military was used against the people in this country during the during the riots that followed the King assassination, and then during the anti-war, the height of the anti-war movement, and then Chicago Democratic Convention. You know, that's one of the things about the Chicago Democratic Convention that people don't realize, that troops from Fort Hood were sent there to become part of the force suppressing the demonstration. And because there was such intense opposition to that, particularly among the black troops, people were being sent into their own cities to shoot their own people, that the military couldn't even use their own troops when they sent them. In some ways, I don't think that was nearly as widely known at the time as some of the other opposition. But it's a very, vibrant part of what was going on at that point.
When we think about Vietnam vets and anti-war activists, one of the iconic images that comes to mind is the one about the Vietnam vet arriving at San Francisco airport and being spat on by a woman in the anti-war movement. And you talk with a guy called Jerry Lemke, who got intrigued by that story. What did he find when he started to look into it?
Well, this is a fascinating part of the film and very, very much something that brings it to the present. What he found, first of all, in a nutshell, is that it didn't happen. That these stories, which were promulgated very widely in the 1980s, and in particular in the period leading up to the American invasion in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War in 1991, were largely mythical, and they were very much a kind of urban myths that kind of sprang up out of a combination of to a large degree, the first incidents of this, being even talked about, were only talked about in culture, in movies, Hollywood movies, and in cartoons like from the G.I. Joe. And then they got picked up and they got spread as part of a very much part of a political thrust of trying to undercut any serious opposition to, particularly to the Gulf War at that point, and previously to that, to American intervention in Latin America. The idea being that if you actively oppose a war that's being fought by American troops, then ipso facto, you are blaming those troops for the war. You are, at least metaphorically, spitting on the troops, and therefore, you're betraying your own people. And this was a big part of the political message that was launched by the Reagan administration when they started trying to rewrite the history of the Vietnam War in the early 1980s. We found a lot of, stuff that we didn't use in the film of Reagan talking about. This was a noble war, and the government betrayed the troops, and the people betrayed the troops when they came home. And, the idea that there was opposition inside the military to the war was completely wiped out of that narrative.
It's, I guess, an indication of how successfully history's been rewritten, that it's that image, people spitting on the troops, that comes to mind, and not the image of Vietnam vets ripping off their medals and hurling them onto the steps of the Capitol building, which you actually have footage of in your film.
Yeah.
What reaction do you get from younger people when they see the movie?
They're shocked, and they're kind of amazed that this could have happened, because the other story, like you're saying, the other image of a narrative of troops being, fighting the war bravely and coming home and being, hated by the people and betrayed by the people in the country. This is so deeply ingrained that even young people who have studied the Vietnam War know nothing about this, just absolutely nothing. And it really kind of, it's unsettling, and it's also liberating in a sense of saying, people realizing, wait a minute, that maybe history is on our side here, and certainly that how deeply, we've been kind of lied to about what really went on during the Vietnam War. When you kind of puncture that, it really opens up a lot of other things to kind of look at with clearer eyes.
Did you find that people were very happy to be speaking with you about this, Vietnam vets?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people talk about, the part of the myth of the GI being spat on is the idea that that people couldn't couldn't talk about the war. Now, to a certain degree, that was true. People coming home, it was very hard to talk about the war. And frankly, where it was mainly hard to talk about the war was when you opposed it. The fact that you realized that this horrendous slaughter that you were part of is something that people didn't want to hear about. But for the GIs who opposed the war, they're the ones who certainly over the last 35 years, whose voice and whose story has really been written out of history and suppressed. And for the 50 plus people that we interviewed, this was a wonderful thing, kind of to the person, to be able to tell their story.
This was obviously a really important part of your personal history and something you feel very strongly about. Why did you wait so long to make the movie?
It's interesting. Well, first off, I didn't start making films until the 90s. But even then, even though I knew this was a story that needed to be told in film, I didn't think it would literally be possible to tell it. I mean, it's not easy to make a film. It costs a lot of money and it takes a lot of work. And money is a big part of it. And it wasn't a story that really felt like it resonated with people, through the 1990s. I mean, there was a lot of, the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement in the 60s being really kind of turned into a cliche and turned into a joke and a stereotype. And to a certain degree, I was worried that it would not be received as much more than a bunch of GIs, being nostalgic about the good old days. What really changed that was, of course, 9/11, the war on terror, and particularly the build-up to the Iraq War. When it became clear to me that suddenly the story of GIs themselves not only questioning but actively opposing the war that they were being charged with fighting spoke to today. And that's certainly been the experience that I've had, is that people have not seen this as a tired story about the 60s, but have seen this as a very kind of alive piece of history, something that speaks directly to them today. And it really, I think, needed that climate for this story to finally kind of take its place in history. And that was a big part of my concern. I didn't want to make a film that was going to be kind of shoved aside and put on the shelf as a not that relevant part of history.
No, the war in Iraq is never mentioned in the movie. I don't think there's one reference to it that I can remember. Was that a conscious decision on your part?
It was. I mean, actually, initially we were going to make a film that was going to kind of toggle back and forth between Iraq and Vietnam, and actually partly through consultation with some of the television networks overseas that were supporting us, we kind of realized that, ironically, in order for the film to really have the most power in relation to Iraq, it was best that the film focus only on the GI movement during the Vietnam War and tell that story in all of its complexity. Because what's happening in Iraq is more akin right now to the early days, to the Howard Levy days of the Vietnam War, although things accelerate very quickly today in a way they didn't back then. And I think there's great potential for the growth of a movement in Iraq to kind of overstep what happened in Vietnam. And certainly there's organizations that are coming up now that are a big part of that. And there's as I understand it, there's a growing deserter community in Canada, people who have gone to Canada in opposition to the war. And that's a very powerful thing that's beginning to happen. But if we had kind of added that to the film, it would have. It's hard to explain, but it in fact would have kind of taken away from the power of the story of the Vietnam War. And when people see this film, they don't need me to tell them that this directly relates to Iraq. I mean, people make that connection themselves, and it's always much better when you can do that. And it prompts people to kind of look into and want to know what's happening in Iraq, and hopefully to kind of help the people who are involved in inside the military and opposing the war today. We in our website we link up to a lot of websites that are part of that.
Is the film slated for general release?
At this point, we are talking now with some distributors who do want to distribute it. We're at least in the United States, we're expecting a release as early as February, probably not until March of this year. It's been a very hard struggle getting distributors to pay attention, even though the film has garnered a number of awards at film festivals. But I think just recently it was announced that the film was nominated for Best Documentary for the Independent Spirit Awards, which is kind of the Independent Academy Awards. And that, I think, has prompted a lot more attention. And so we are hoping to have it in general release in theaters, at least in the U.S. in March, and I'm hoping in Canada as well. And then a television broadcast in the summer.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me this morning, David.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with David Zeiger. He's director of Sir, No Sir, and you can see the film tomorrow in Vancouver, and it's at 3 p.m. at the Pacific Cinematheque, and that's on Howe Street.